The hiatus is over. The streak has begun once again. It is Tavern Voices. My name is Kevin King, and with me, as always, is Tyler Crawley, the radio host extraordinaire and global elitist from Southeastern North Carolina. How's it going, my friend?
It's good. It's good. I like being a global elitist. I like being a global coastal elitist, because I feel like sometimes people in D.C. are called like coastal elitists, but they're not really on the coast. I mean, they kind of are. I mean, like, we're right on the water down here. So I feel like I'm far more of a coastal elitist than some people in D.C. and even New York in some places. So I'm proud to hold that title.
Yeah, you really need to work on your like Southern elitist accent, that like plantation owner, like the guy from House of Cards, whatever, Frank Underwood.
I was gonna do more of the Cartman from South Park. Remember, he pretends to be the plantation owner, and he's like, "Oh, I love what you're doing here with your slaves. Student athletes." That was one of the first episodes that ever called out the student athlete, just sort of ridiculousness that goes on with how much money those players make for these universities, and it's like, oh, they're student athletes, so we just give them tuition. And I'm not saying that we should pay them and go crazy, but that was like the first time I ever heard it. And now it's like a major conference. South Park is always ahead of the game. Always.
South Park is the leading edge of reason, which we should step back as a society and ask why a cartoon made for adults is the leading edge of critical thinking. Because really and truthfully, they've had some of the best analogies for current events and political shenanigans of any other show. I mean, I think Saturday Night Live tries to touch on it, and they just are so out of touch they can't do it.
Well, I think cartoons have always, I mean, Simpsons, I remember when I was in college, we used to joke around about how anything that happens in your life can be related to a Simpsons episode. In the last 10 years, it's been pretty bad. But South Park then, I think, kind of picked up the baton and ran with it. I know more political than I think the Simpsons ever was. But the greatest thing I love about South Park is that everyone argues it's a conservative show, which it definitely is. But they said that they're not conservative. They just said that we want to make fun of whoever's not being made fun of. And they're like, nobody makes fun of liberals, at least well. There's a lot of like, you know, so-called conservative comedians, and they're always awful. Anyone that has to like identify themselves with a word before comedian is not good. Because comedian should be all you have to hear. But whenever someone's like, oh, I'm a feminist comedian or a conservative comedian, it's like, well, you're not very good if you have to like classify it and get all specific. But they said that we make fun of whoever's not being made fun of. And he's like, no one makes fun of liberals. And so that's who we went after. And that's why they went after, you know, remember the big Muhammad episode where they were going to draw him? And I mean, because why? No one goes after Islam, right? Christianity's fair game. Judaism's fair game, but no one goes after Islam. And so that's why they went after that. And they went after, you know, all these religions and Scientology and everything else. And they just go after whoever no one else is going after. And it just so happens that it tends to be the left-leaning in this country. But I think they're probably libertarian, as most super rich people are. But they're not. They said they're not conservative. They just make fun of liberals because no one else does.
Oh, I absolutely think that they are more libertarian. I'd say probably even before they became rich. But they definitely try to keep a pulse on. And I think that's what makes it good, is that it does inevitably make fun of both sides, which I think no other group of people really is able to do, unless you're kind of in that libertarian standing outside of the circle. Yeah. And able to say, OK, here's what's going on. Let me make fun of everyone involved. And not, because I think, you know, I mentioned briefly Saturday Night Live. That's why they have such a hard time making fun of Republicans, is it comes from such a place where they really actually hate them that they can't make something objectively funny.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. Like I said, whenever your ideology is the basis for your comedy, yes, you can be funny sometimes. Because like Jon Stewart was funny, but towards the end, he stopped being as funny. And he still was funny. He's still, I think, way better than all the late night hosts that are on right now, because he even did call out liberals and Democrats for some of the ridiculousness that they were, causing in Washington. But as he got more partisan, it was less funny because it became more about making a point. And what's weird about South Park is they actually do both. And I don't know which one they do first. I'm not sure if they're like, hey, we're going to make this point and then how we make it funny. Or if they're like, hey, this is really funny and how can we make a point out of this? I don't know. But whatever they do is magical. And I think it's because they don't have an emotional attachment. Like, liberals can make fun of liberals, but you can see it, like, hurts inside of them when they do it. Like, you can see their eyes. Like, they're just, like, they're, like, on the verge of tears. Like, I can't believe we're doing this. But the South Park guys truly have no allegiance. And I think that allows them to really just go after whoever and call out BS, which is always really the entire purpose of comedy. But I actually, it's funny, I did want to turn that into, did you read that Ben Shapiro Weekly Standard article that he wrote about the division between the conservatives, older and younger conservatives?
No, I did not, actually.
Oh, it was like 2 weeks ago he wrote it. And the whole point was, is he said that younger conservatives lean libertarian and there are other issues involved. But that was one of the big points that he made. That separated older conservatives from younger conservatives. He also talked about younger conservatives look at character because they didn't live through like the Clinton years and everything else that sort of jaded, I think, some of the older conservatives. But he talked about libertarianism. And I think that's important because if you look at the Republican Party as a whole, I think Ronald Reagan used to say that libertarianism was like one of the three legs of conservatism and how important libertarianism was. And I consider myself a libertarian except for foreign policy. I can't get on board with some of the ideas that they push forward. Like, just leave everyone alone and we're all going to sing Kumbaya and it's going to be awesome. I can't get on board with that.
You're not a libertarian, but continue.
Well, it means not necessarily because I also don't necessarily believe in nation building. But I don't believe that we should just get out of, you know, just let the Middle East handle the Middle East. I mean, if Iran builds a nuclear weapon, they're going to do something with it. And it kind of freaks me out. And so I'm more libertarian on economic issues. But I also think that you can have a sort of opinion where, just like economics, it's not anarchy. There are rules and regulations and other things that need to be met. And libertarians believe in the legal system, so it's not a free-for-all. And I don't think that foreign policy should be that way. We need to have a standard and everything else. But I don't want to get off the point. The reason I'm bringing that up is that one of the big stories in North Carolina last week was the announcement of incentive reform. And I got really excited when I heard that because usually when conservatives say reform, they're going to reform something from a conservative perspective, which usually means less government. If something's going to be harder to get, so if you're going to do entitlement reform, it's harder to get entitlements. Welfare, harder to get welfare. Regulatory reform, it's going to be harder to put regulations in effect. But for some reason, they called it incentive reform, and they did something liberal, and they made incentives more generous and easier to get. And arguably, it's all because they want to get this Apple campus here in North Carolina. And I was just very disappointed because I got really excited when I saw the headline. And then I read it and I went, what? The Republicans are the ones pushing this? I mean, it sounded like something that Roy Cooper would have been behind, which I think he is supporting it. It doesn't go far enough, I think, in his opinion. But I just couldn't believe it. It's the one time that I've really been disappointed in the North Carolina GOP on a financial issue. In the incentive reform was not – it was reform, but it was liberal reform. It wasn't conservative reform.
Yeah. You know, it was funny when you were talking about how the younger conservative generation tends to lean a little bit more libertarian. I actually had a conversation the other night with a friend of mine who made the comment that he said, I made my transition from a neocon to more libertarian through a free market class that he took during college. Yeah. And that's the same sort of conversation I have with so many people our age. And I say this as I'm wearing a Rand Paul t-shirt podcasting with you. But, you know, if you want to join my club, I like to call it conservatarian. Rule of law, limited government, not the anarchy or complete abolition of government, but, you know, a real strict, confined government, because I think that's what we need. So if you want to be a conservatarian with me, we can do it together.
No, I like that. Was that the name of was that Charles C.W. Cook's book? Was that conservatarian?
I'm not sure
along those lines. I think it was something along those lines. But yeah, I mean, that's probably more where I am, where it's I agree on principle with the idea of, oh, well, we'll just let everyone have their own devices. And if a company's poisoning their product, then enough people will find out and they'll stop buying it. It's like, yeah, but then people have to die in order for us to find that out. So if we can stop those people from dying, I'm okay with that. And it's like, I'm okay with some regulations. I'm okay with, you know, some taxes and all of these things. And so it's like, yeah, I guess I'm not a full-blown libertarian, but I guess that's the problem with our political system nowadays, is that, I mean, people joke about how we only have Republican Democrat. True, but then we have libertarian, and yeah, the problem is like, yeah, I guess I'm somewhere in between there, between libertarian and Republican. But it's just disappointing to see these incentives, because, I mean, any independent study that's done, we know that the film industry will be like, oh, film incentives are great. Look at our new study. And, you know, manufacturing's like, look at all these manufacturing studies that show incentives are great. But independent studies have found for like 30 years that incentives are just a big waste of money, that it's not a deciding factor. It has nowhere near the impact they think it does. And all it does is cost taxpayers money. And I don't blame the companies for doing it. As I always say, I blame the government for giving it to them, because I'm a business owner. Yeah, I mean, why not go to the government and go, yeah, you want to give us $5 million to set up shop? No? Okay, well, we're going to do it anyway. We just thought we'd ask. And then some governments were like, yeah, we'll give you $5 million. And so to me, it's picking winners and losers. It's an awful thing. But real quick, I do want to point out that at least the ideology is consistent with Republicans. Republicans believe giving money to businesses, supply-side economics, to the ones that create the supply, is better for the economy. So even though I hate it, at least it's ideologically consistent. Democrats on this issue are insane. I mean, they're bipolar. I was actually on Capitol Tonight last week debating a Democrat, and she was arguing for incentives. And I didn't have enough time, but I wanted to be like, oh, so you agree with lowering the corporate tax rate? Like, So giving Apple money is awesome. They're going to come here and they're going to have all these jobs. But why not just do that to everybody? So, yeah, I mean, liberals, especially Roy Cooper, are just bipolar on this issue. But I hate it. But at least Republicans are less inconsistent, I should say.
Yeah, well, there's two points on that. And I had one point, but I'm going to save that because I actually think I came up with a better point. What if instead of incentive packages, we have what we call like introductory tax brackets, right? And we say Apple or you know, Caterpillar, Volvo, or whoever the major company is, you know, Amazon. And we say, we're going to have an introductory or a brand new tax bracket that you're going to be the first company to get this tax rate. But then we're going to phase other companies into it over the next 10 years, right? Like work together. Say, yeah, technically it's an incentive, but also technically it's helping every other business that employs everyone else in the state.
Yeah, so I like anything that proves that lowering taxes works. It's that simple. Now, I don't like that we, you know, pick who gets it. I don't like that we penalize companies that have been here. I think that, you know, if I was a company and I'd been in North Carolina for like 15 years, especially like here in Southeastern North Carolina, we had a company that closed up shop when the economy got bad. And now they're thinking about reopening and they're asking for an incentive. And I think if I remember correctly, they voted for it. And I said, why are you going to reward? So the companies that stuck it out, made payroll, you know, kept people employed, they get what, the shaft? And the company that, you know, when the going got tough, they got going. We're going to reward that? Like, I don't get that. That doesn't make any sense to me.
No, not at all. And that's, you know, the second point I wanted to bring up, and I think it ties into what has been happening, you know, kind of in the news here lately with the teacher protest and with, I mean, really any other major news story about the legislature, they're always painted as these awful, evil people. Yeah. But how much of all of these decisions now are not really even made remotely on a philosophical basis? It's on election points. Because we can't get the other 90% of the stuff we want to get done if we're not in power, right? I mean, that's what the Democrats did for 100 years in this state. Yeah. They controlled the power so they could do whatever they wanted. They could bicker over the 10% of issues because they could ram through the other 90% of issues on any given Sunday. Not that the legislature, you know, it's a phrase, but they, But now I think that's what everything is viewed as. It's if we don't win political points, we're going to lose power and then we can't do anything. So they look at something like Apple and go, well, you know, if we lose this, or if not even if we lose it, but if we could get this, how will this help us win the election? And then we can do the mass income tax reform and education reform and all the other pieces that they've been working on over the last 8 years. So, I mean, I think that's where the difficult part lies. And you see people like you and I who are ideologically minded going, this is against everything that you say you're for, yet there seems to be a disconnect. And I think this is why, because it's viewed more as one piece of a chess game. And that makes it incredibly difficult on people like you and I who really have a hard time finding our place amongst the, you know, I was talking to that same friend the other night and I said, you know, I'm definitely not a Democrat. I know that for sure. But there's a lot of days I'm not a Republican either. And when you end up as a man with no country, it can become very disenfranchising.
That's true. I mean, there's no doubt that we're experiencing that right now with both parties. People very unhappy with the two presidential nominees. A lot of Bernie Sanders people weren't happy with Hillary, and a lot of conservatives weren't happy with Trump. And clearly, more conservatives became happier with Trump than liberals became happier with Hillary. And I think that on that level has caused all these questions to be asked. And everyone always talks about third party this and third party that. And I think that's why it's important that we talk about these social issues or social state issues, because really what happens on the national level is not that. I mean, every once in a while you have an Obamacare, but for the most part, it's like what? Farm bills and budgets and the debt goes up and everyone freaks out. We should be freaked out about it. But what changed from Trump to Obama? Nothing. I mean, not with regards to spending. And you are seeing some changes on the judicial level. But once again, unless you're affected by one of these judicial rulings, it's not going to have that big of an impact. However, the things that happen on the state level, you know, for example, when they decided to save Uber, you know, here in Wilmington, they were deciding they were going to get rid of Uber. They were like, no, yeah, we're going to get rid of it because, you know, they love the taxi cartel and they loved the way they had it set up and they were making all this money. And Uber was going to come in and so they were going to block it. And the state said, nope, sorry, we're going to allow it. That was a huge decision. Huge impact on North Carolina because a lot of municipalities were going to ban Uber. And I can't even imagine a world where Uber doesn't exist anymore. I actually sometimes find myself thinking, what did I do before Uber? Like, I can't remember. I guess I called cabs or I drove somewhere. And then if I couldn't drive home, I got a cab. And then I had to call a cab. And it sounds so awful because it's so easy now with Uber. But that's a huge decision that just things like that don't happen on the national level. And so I think that's, you know, and also I think it's also funny that a lot of the big issues that we do talk about that get all the attention, there's so much that's happening in politics that really isn't ideologically based. Like when they decide things like down here in Southeastern North Carolina for dredging and beach renourishment, like whether it's David Rauser or a Democrat in the 7th Congressional District seat, they're both going to be fighting for that. And so it is funny that we always talk, you know, that you watch the news and everyone's talking about the Russia collusion and they're talking about, you know, these big stories, but they really have no impact. But if we get beach renourishment down here, saves the beaches, keeps them from going under, keeps the economy going, that's huge, but that's not political. And so it's just kind of funny that so much of what happens we all probably do agree with, but no one ever talks about those things.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about how, so I told you that not everyone listening, but I've told you, Tyler, that I started reading Suicide of the West by Jonah Goldberg. And it's a fantastic book so far. And one of the things that he talks about is he kind of says, let's step back for a moment and look at where we are today in context of the entire history of humankind. Right. And when you start to look at things in perspective, it really changed. I mean, the last few weeks I've started to kind of think about politics in a completely different way and about how as humans, we did so many things a certain way for several hundred thousand years. And then in the last 250, we decided this whole self-governance thing might work. And so like everything else, it's spiraled to a point where I don't know what comes next. Because really, this has never been tried ever before. And we're at a point where I think it's become so complex in a way that the founders never envisioned that bureaucracy and government would get to this point, because, I mean, it had never happened before. They were afraid of a monarchy or some sort of, you know, dictator or military authoritarianship. But they never thought that we would just create this giant Leviathan. And, you know, so with that in place, it's like when you talk about how much things don't change when you put somebody in office, I think we've reached that point that we're finally at critical mass of the wheel just keeps spinning no matter who's driving the, you know, who's driving the car. Like to change lanes at this point in the sports car of government is a monumental undertaking, much less trying to slow it down or turn around. So I don't know what you do next. I mean, I really don't mean that from a disastrous perspective, but from just a rational, logical, how do you change anything that is going the way it's going now? I don't know an easy answer to tweak things. And I think the only thing that we have seen is how states have changed. And this has all happened in the last, 15 years when legislatures started turning from Democrat controlled for 100 years to Republican, whether it be Wisconsin and North Carolina and states all across the country.
Yes, I do think that. First of all, yeah, I want to read that Jonah Goldberg book. I mean, it sounds to me a lot like, what was that, 5,000 year leap or 1,000 year leap?
3,000, 5,000, something like that, the year miracle.
Yeah, and that's what it kind of sounds like. And I always love those books like that, because they talk about these things and they also show us where we were. I mean, the thing I've heard about Goldberg's book is that it talks about how – and I think this was, I know he did an interview about this. I saw it on Morning Joe. And he was talking about how there's been this massive, you know, for I think, what was it? Almost the entirety of humankind, we've been living on like a dollar a day, if that. And this is the first time in like the last 100 years that we're seeing the majority of the world is now rich. Beyond what we ever thought possible. And it's because of capitalism and liberal democracy and all of these things that are happening. And from what I've heard, you know, his whole book is on the idea that it's almost like we're almost getting like complacent with everything that's going on. And maybe not even complacent is the word to use.
Well,
but it's like we're just not aware of how great we have it. And you know, I was reading something the other day about school shootings and homicides and just how low the crime rate is versus where we were like in the 70s and 80s. When we're at a point in the early 90s and late 80s where people were almost going to throw their hands up and go, how are we going to stop this? And then just, you know, magically the crime rate started going away. And everyone has their theory for why that did happen. But it's amazing where we are from just where we were 20, 30 years ago. But because of the social media and because of the internet, because 24/7 news, if something happens or a cop gets shot, oh my gosh, there's a, you know, it's an epidemic that police are getting shot. Black guy gets shot. It's an epidemic that black people are getting. It's the shark attack effect. You know, that one year where everyone was talking about shark attacks, there was no increase in shark attacks. It was just the press covered it more. And school shootings are down, according to this report. And so it's just, it's almost because things are too good that we have too much. I remember when I was in college and I had so much free time. I think I was working like part-time, was in college. And I remember I was always convinced that I had some like life-ending disease. I was always like, oh, I've got this, I've got that. Like I was, because all I did was sit around all day and had nothing to do. So I worried. And once I started working and doing, you don't have time to like sit around and go and worry about stuff. You gotta get work done. And I feel like that's where we are as a society. That now, because things are so good, we have so much time that we can look out and find stuff and complain about it, where in the past, we just wouldn't have the time to do that. And I think it's a sign of how great things are. But, and yes, there are people out there that aren't better. I mean, it's you can find exceptions always. But I think it just goes to show that's the fact that we are worried about the debt, the fact that we do have time to worry about. I mean, back in the day, the majority of people didn't know about this stuff. Couldn't follow it, couldn't watch it, and now you can. And so I think it's the fact that we can be informed on this and know what's going on, I think is just proof of how great things are.
Right. I mean, you know, a lot of what his book talks about is that there is a natural state of humanity. And if you look at it from a just an evolutionary perspective, we have so much ingrained in our brains from that 250,000 years where we did instinctual human things, the things that got us to survive, the things that got us to where we were in our place in the world. And now, you know, so a lot of these things, I mean, capitalism is unnatural. Freedom is unnatural. Slavery has existed for pretty much the entirety of humankind. We often talk about, you know, the period of American slavery, but they don't talk about the fact that tens of thousands of years man has been enslaving other man, right? Or whatever, mankind. What's the gender neutral version of man? But
person kind.
So of all,
like China person. Remember?
What was that?
Don Blankenship in West Virginia when he got in trouble for calling Mitch McConnell's in-laws China people.
Right.
Everyone was like, oh, it's great that he was gender neutral, didn't call them Chinamen, but still you called them China people. I think they're American citizens.
That's not the preferred nomenclature.
Exactly. Sorry. But yeah. So it would be person kind, I believe, is the term to use.
Yeah. So, I mean, and capitalism and freedom has allowed us to advance so far because before this, there was no commerce. There was no way of trusting someone else. There was no way of getting something without killing someone for it or beating them or taking it from them or something. You know, I mean, obviously, barter system, you know, evolved into what we have today. So it's like when you look at it from that perspective of how far we've come and how great we are that we don't live, you know, in the Byzantine Empire, but people get so caught up in all of these small postmodernist debates. I mean, that we can actually sit down and have a discussion about genders and gender neutral pronouns and all of these modern concepts is the fact that we are so blessed as a, you know, as a species. Right. I mean, if we were in the Saharan plains, like any other wild animal, we'd still be killing each other. So, but I think all of that's lost. And that's the point that he's getting to in the book, that we're to a point now where we talk about, like you said, things that are, in my opinion, very kind of bourgeoisie. And that's the average person. I mean, there are protests all the time about all kinds of different subjects. And we're free and able to do that. We're not having to help lay a railroad or plow fields or all of these other things that we did over the last thousands of years.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, what's the big complaint you hear from people? Like, you know, like they're struggling to get by, like they're barely making ends meet. They're never going to be able to retire. And it's like, that's amazing. Like the fact that that's a problem. Like back in the day, no one retired. You just worked in the farm and, you know, until you died or until you were, you know, you couldn't and you had to just sit in the house. You basically worked until you couldn't work anymore. And now people quit work voluntarily, you know, not laborious jobs, but jobs like in offices that people back in the day would have prayed for and would have probably sold their family in slavery for. But I'm glad you brought up the slavery thing, because does he address, because one of my favorite articles, I have a lot of favorite articles that Kevin Williamson's written, but he wrote one where he was talking about the victim mentality that so many people have. And he talked about his mother actually in the article and how everywhere they went, it was always like her favorite phrase was, "That's how they get you." And he talked about like when they go to a restaurant, because I guess he grew up pretty poor. And he said they go to a restaurant every once in a while. And also, let's also not forget that back in the day, people didn't go to restaurants very often. It was like a fancy thing that you did once a month with the family. And nowadays, people eat out like every night in some cases, or at least once or twice a week. And we forget like how that was not very common. But he said when they go to a restaurant and his mom would order a Dr. Pepper and they put too much ice in it, she'd say, "That's how they get you. They give you too much ice, too much Dr. Pepper." And if she'd go out another time and they didn't put enough ice in, she'd say, "That's how they get you, because they're not giving me enough ice and they're going to water down my drink." So it didn't matter what they did. It was always, "That's how they get you." And she just had this victim mentality. And to me, I wonder if that plays in to, you know, all these conspiracy theories that exist on the right and left, the Bilderbergs, the, you know, Bohemian Grove, the Illuminati, all this stuff, and even what's the deep state, and all these things play into people's belief that we're not free. Like they just can't fathom that nobody is controlling it, that someone has to be controlling it, and that's, you know, and that makes them, and I've always argued there's a safety in that, because if, you know, one of the things to me that's been the most terrifying is that there's not a God. Like, there being a God to me is so much more comforting, because it means someone's controlling everything. He would never let, or, you know, he would never let something like that happen. But if there's nothing controlling it, then you're right. Anything could happen. Our, you know, we could have a catastrophic, a what do they call it? What's it called? They always say in the movies, like a life-ending event on Earth. We could have an asteroid hit. We could have a volcano erupt. Like, there's no one controlling it, then any of those things could happen. But if there's a God, he would never let that happen. And so there's something sort of comforting about that. I think it's the same thing with the deep state and all these Bilderbergs and the Rockefellers controlling the weather. And there's something comforting about people controlling things, because that means that we can't screw it up. So if we elect, you know, someone president, you know, that's an idiot, that, don't worry, the people in control are not going to let, you know, that guy or woman launch a nuclear weapon and destroy the world as we know it. They're in control of things. They're going to make sure that doesn't happen. And I wonder how that kind of plays in, because remember that great quote from Mad Men when it's the first season and he's hanging out with all those, what was the old phrase for hipsters? I know, this is gonna drive me crazy. It begins with the B, doesn't it? The Beatniks, is that what it was?
Beatniks, yeah.
Yeah, Beatniks. And, you know, they're high, and the guy says something about, like, you're part of the machine and all this stuff, and he goes, there is no machine, there is no anything. He's like, the universe is indifferent. And the guy's like, why'd you have to say that, man? Like, you just totally bummed that guy out. Because he pointed out that there's no one in charge. Like, no one cares about you. No one's trying to get you. No one cares. And that is terrifying, because people like to think, like, oh, they're trying to get me, like, because I know, like, I really know what's going on. And I wonder what role that plays in sort of our psyche, because for so long people have told us what to do, when to eat, where to eat, what, you know, and now all of a sudden we're free, and we, like, you know, it's, what do they call it when people leave prison and they want to go back? I can't remember.
Like Stockholm syndrome?
No, there's a term they have for people in prison. And when they've been there so long and then they go out in the free world, they can't handle it, because all of a sudden they have all this freedom and they're so used to people telling them what to do. I can't remember what it's called now. There's a psychological term. But I wonder if that's what's playing out in humanity. And because for so long we've been enslaved and been told, and now suddenly we have all this freedom and we're just like, no, we don't want this. And so we're willing to give it up and do something like socialism or you know, statism and communism and all these things, because, hey, we'll put someone in charge and that'll be better than having us in charge.
And every time that happens, it generally happens fair. I don't want to say fairly smoothly. Like, sure, there are battles, but often millions of people are enslaved without putting up a lot of a fight. Right.
Yeah.
In fact, that's in the I was just rewatching all of the Marvel Universe after seeing the latest Avengers. And that's in the first Avengers when Loki comes and he says, bow, that's your natural position. And that's a key concept in that movie was, are people going to be ruled? Is that, I feel like my draw is coming out. I'm not saying ruled very well, but they want to be subjects. And when you look at it historically, it's crazy. And that's what I can never understand, is why we don't look at things more from a primal perspective. Or, you know, when we see someone commit random violence, whether it be in a school or at a venue or where have you, or for religious reasons or whatever else, why don't we look and say, as a species, what is causing this animal? I mean, if there was a pack of dogs just attacking people in town, they would try to understand what was going on with the dogs, right? So why don't we do the same thing with humans? But I think that's a total other path, because to the point that you were saying about you know, all the conspiracies, and I think that it's really difficult for people to
well, hold on, before you jump on to that.
No, go back.
I did want to point out, you're talking about people like wanting to be ruled and everything like that. Do you remember that famous poem? I'm going to butcher the guy's name, Martin Niemöller or whatever. He wrote the it's the first they came for, and, you know, he says, you know, first they came for them and I didn't say anything because I wasn't that, and then they came for that and I didn't say anything because I wasn't that, and then finally they came for me. and there was no one left to speak up. It's a famous poem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you're talking obviously about what happened with how Nazis took over. But I think that that's also that plays into what you were just going to, where if there are people in charge, like I said, then they're not going to let that crazy thing happen. But if we're the ones in charge, and so we're afraid because we're like, oh no, I don't want to stand up and do anything. So that's why it's so easy for these people and these dictators and these despots to take over people, because everyone goes, oh, don't worry, you know, the good guys or someone else is going to do it. And so if you already believe that there's this shadow organization controlling everything, then you don't have to stand up and do anything. Don't worry, they're going to take care of it. They're not going to let this thing happen. And so I think it allows people to sort of not be as involved for both, you know, from both perspectives. Either one, it doesn't matter if we do anything. What does it matter if I vote? They've already decided the election. Or two, they're not going to let anything crazy happen, so I'll just let them handle it anyway. So it allows people to sort of be complacent and allows, you know, people to sort of not be involved if you believe that thing. But I think that's another reason why it's so easy for these for humans to get taken over, because everyone assumes that everyone else is going to be the one that's going to do something. And that's why, you know, when that guy from the Waffle House stopped that shooter, that was amazing, because I'm not a guy that would do that. Like, if there's a shooter, that's like insane. Like, I look at people like that, I'm just in just awe that someone has that inside of them. Same thing with soldiers, you know, people that choose to fight for this country. Like, that's just so amazing. Like, I don't have that in me. And so people that do, I'm just like amazed by it. And the problem is that most people are like me. I mean, the majority of the population, what, like 3% of the country serves the country. And correct. So yep. That means the majority of people are sort of in this place where it's like, we'll let someone else handle it. And that's how it's so easy to take people over, because, you know, once all you got to do is defeat the group that will uprise. And then everyone else is like, all right, we're not going to deal with that. We're going to fall in line. What's the quote from... What's the movie where the guy, I can't remember, but the guy says something basically along the lines of, I'd rather be like a pet than be their food. I think it was like from Blade. And so people are like, well, I'd rather be like, you know, enslaved than be murdered. And so people just succumb and just do whatever they have to do. But we're getting too far off topic, because I did want to go back to the whole conspiracy theory thing.
Yeah, I mean, well, my point maybe was not directly to the conspiracy theories, because I don't know whether Build-A-Bear is a conspiratorial organization or not.
I thought you. I was like, did he just say Build-A-Bear? Like, that's how they put microphones and cameras in the eyes. That's yes. That's how they spy on the next generation.
I would really believe it. I've been sitting on that joke for like 7.5 minutes now, and I've been waiting all the way to now.
Can we please go to like where the next Bilderberg meeting and showed up with Build-A-Bear signs and be like, get out of our malls, get out of our malls. And like Alex Jones will be there, like all the InfoWars nuts. And like, we'll be there with like our Build-A-Bear signs. Like, that would be like the most epic troll of Alex Jones. It would just be, did you ever see the Daily Show? Where the guy
in general, yes.
Not the Daily Show. It's that new show. It's like the guy pretending to be Trevor Noah, pretending to be Stephen Colbert, pretending to be Jon Stewart. Like, I don't even know what incarnation this is. But it was actually kind of funny. This guy approaches Alex Jones and accuses Alex Jones of not being the real Alex Jones. And he's like, you're not a real Alex Jones. Like, the Alex Jones that I know is crazy, and you're way too calm. And like, he starts getting Alex Jones all riled up, and then he starts like knowing exactly. Oh, it's so funny, because – I mean, I don't like this Daily Show, but I really don't like Alex Jones, and they just troll him. I mean, like, their argument is that he is not the real Alex Jones. Like, he's a fake Alex Jones. And I just love that they're doing like a play on the whole crisis actor thing, saying he's not the real one. And it's so funny, because I don't think he even got sort of the satirical take that they were making on him. But it's so easy to rile him up. But it was pretty funny. But I'm sorry, I got us off topic again.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. And I'm going to touch on that just briefly, because the episode of the Joe Rogan Show with Alex Jones on it has got to be some of the best podcast material ever.
They're friends, aren't they? Kind of? Or they know each other?
I think kind of. I mean, Joe Rogan pretty much says you're crazy several times throughout the thing. But he says, how do you know? Because, I mean, they're actually Googling stuff he's rattling off, like you know, secret project numbers and the military. And like, this is actually all true. Like the stuff he's saying is, you know, and so they kind of get at how he's just like, I think he's just one of those really sharp, almost in a way of like a Robin Williams, like their brain is so sharp and running 100 miles an hour that the average person is just, you know, blown away. But anyway, I don't want Alex Jones to be.
Wait, so he was right on some of the stuff that he was saying? Is that wait?
Yeah. No, that's what Joe Rogan was saying. And I mean, they were looking up like project numbers he was rattling off and things.
He's got like a good memory, but like his arguments. Absolutely. But I mean, like his arguments about like, this is where they're testing the, you know, chemtrails. Oh, no. Okay. So that's what I was trying to figure out. Like, I mean, yeah, memorizing project numbers is impressive because my memory's not that great. But I just wanted to make it clear he wasn't like getting it right about his crazy conspiracy theories.
No, not at all.
He just is good at memorizing stuff.
Yeah, well, and that's what they were saying. He's not. I don't think he's crazy. He's actually got a lot of brain power.
Well, somebody said if you tailor it back a little bit, like his show. I mean, every time I've watched a clip, I watch the whole thing. Like he's so entertaining. But if he just tailored it back and was, you know, not so crazy. They were like, he can make a fortune in talk radio because I think he'd have one of the top shows, but no one's going to put him on their station because he's such a nut job. I mean, you can't go on there talking about Sandy Hook parents being crisis actors and how their kids didn't really – you can't say that crap on radio. I mean, you're going to get sued and everything else. But they said he's such a good host, and, I mean, he knows when to get, like, dramatic. And, I mean, he's very entertaining, and that's what talk radio is supposed to be. If he just tailored it back a little bit, he'd probably be one of the best hosts. I hate to admit that.
Probably so. No. Well, you know, I listen to your show sometimes and I think, man, that reminds me a lot of Alex Jones. So.
Just because my voice is a little hoarse is really the, I'll take that.
Yeah.
I've always been worried someone's going to, you know, because I have some crazy callers. And I bet they listen to InfoWars, and I'm always like worried they're gonna, because I've been on the air and I've been like, Alex Jones is a nut job, an awful human being, and just like I don't want him. I don't think he would, because he'd probably look at it as punching down. I mean, he's this big like national host. I'm this little small rinky dink host. But even if he did, like he just like came after, like just the amount of crap that I would get from his crazy followers, it always like worried me. Like I'm like, oh no, I upset like the beast. And I could just only imagine getting on the bad side of InfoWars, because Ben Shapiro and him were fighting, what was that, 2 weeks ago? And Ben Shapiro was just getting it. Oh, man, they were going after him.
Oh, I know. I mean, because, yeah, it was with the whole like a Kanye thing going on.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like, don't go on that show. And then, oh, man, he's like, I know his investors. And he's like, he's not a businessman. We're independent. And it's like, yeah, really? Like, your only advertiser is vitamins. Like, I think we got the idea that you weren't corporate bought. But yeah, so they were going back and forth. I mean, it was pretty nuts. But he had a Ben Shapiro impersonation. It's pretty bad. Alex Jones did. It wasn't. You know who's got a really good one? Steven Crowder has got a really good Ben Shapiro impersonation.
Thanks for sharing that. I'll have to.
He did like a Frank Underwood, Ben Shapiro skit, and it was pretty funny. Like Steven Crowder, I think like 10% of the stuff he does is funny, and that was one of the 10%. So if you get a chance, check it out.
I will. I will have to do that later. You know, maybe we can find it for, you know, because last episode we got a little Archer in to the podcast. So if I can find the clip, I will make sure it is included for the listening enjoyment of the people who have just basically heard us have a phone conversation for the last 45 minutes.
That's what podcasting is, isn't it?
Well, that's what people don't understand. This is exactly what our phone call would be like. This isn't production.
No.
This isn't stage. This is,
but
we pretty much at some point we start talking like this. I say, let's go ahead and hit the button, start recording. And then after we're done, we'll be here for like another 10 minutes.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we were going to get into like a bunch of other issues that we didn't even come close to getting to. But no, speaking of cartoons, we're going to go back to cartoons. I would argue that Archer is probably the smartest show on television. Like just the dialogue. Yeah, they got a new season coming out because I saw it on Twitter. It was advertised. They have, I mean, the dialogue I mean, sometimes I miss jokes. Like, you go back and you're like, holy crap, that was like, it almost like goes over my head sometimes. Like, some of the jokes that they make are so subtle that you're like, whoa. I mean, I really do think, I don't know who writes that show, but they are some smart people because some of the jokes they make are so like subtle and funny and not necessarily topical, but they'll deal with like history. Like, they'll make like some obscure like gulag joke or something. I mean, like, it's nuts. Like, the historical references they make in the show, especially from a geopolitical standpoint, you have to have your computer with you so you can like look up what they're talking about. But I think that's the best written show, smartest written show on television.
I mean, I enjoyed the first. I lost track after probably three seasons.
Yeah. Well, remember who the original villain was?
The original villain.
The original enemy of the Archer spy company. What was it called? I can't remember. It was ISIS.
Oh, it was. And you're correct.
When ISIS got really popular, or not really popular, but when it blew up in the news.
The bad pun.
Yeah, I know. And so what happened, thanks Obama, thanks for making them popular. But they just got rid of it on the show. Like, they just like totally just got rid of it. And then they did one, I think, what was set. It was like, they did a couple seasons where one was like set in the 80s, and then they did like you're right, I haven't seen them. I watched, I think, one season a couple weeks ago. I binge watched one. Their original, was their name ISIS or was their competitor name ISIS? I think their name was ISIS, if I'm correct.
It may have been. You're correct. You may have been. We'll have to
shut it down, and they like renamed the agency. But I remember that was a big controversy because everyone was worried about them being named ISIS when ISIS, who was really the JV squad, all of a sudden took over and became a real threat to the United States. And so they had to change the name. But that show, from just go back and watch like the first couple seasons, like, so funny. And even the new ones I've seen, like the advertisements, hysterical. So good.
Well, you know, when Archer came out, you had Archer, the first couple of seasons hit the same time as the first couple of seasons of The League. And I think FX had, and they still had Justified on. I mean, that was like the FX heyday. They had some great content.
Did they have Sons of Anarchy?
Yeah, Sons of Anarchy was on there too.
Oh, I mean,
and I feel like something else was on FX at the time.
Nip Tuck was on there. Nip Tuck was the first. That was the first show that took FX into the sort of dark kind of television. Not dark, but just like more adult and serious kind of things.
You loved Nip Tuck. I recall
it was good. Well, I mean, because it was sort of a lot. I mean, that was really the first show that, because I think Nip Tuck was trying to be on a couple stations, and FX was the one that picked it up, kind of like Mad Men. Because Mad Men, originally I was reading, was trying to go to FX, and they didn't want it. HBO didn't want it, and then they ended up on AMC. So Mad Men then kicked off all these great AMC shows that exist. But I think Nip Tuck was the first one for FX, and that led to them making sort of some of these other decisions that were clearly beneficial. But I think that kicked it off. And then, yeah, I mean, FX for a while had some amazing. I don't even know. They probably still do. I just don't watch television anymore. It's like I wait for it to be on Netflix or Amazon Prime, and that's the extent of my television viewing experience.
I was about to ask the same question. I said they could still have good content, but I just don't watch TV anymore. We, you know, because us millennials, we can't afford cable. That's another thing.
Actually,
that,
what's funny is,
you know, the baby boomers
totally can
destroyed for us. Who can afford cable?
Well, the thing is, okay, first of all, like one day I like broke down the numbers, and I was paying probably with everything that I have. So I have like Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu, and then I have Sling, and I had like one of like the higher packages, and I was like, I'm paying like $80 a month. Like that's what a cable bill is. I mean, if you only have like one room or, you know, or two rooms, which is what most people used to have. I was like, man, I'm paying about, so I scaled back a bunch, and I got the MLB package recently. So I was like, man, I'm paying like $100 a month for all this stuff, thinking I'm saving money. And all I'm doing is paying for all the stuff that I'm not watching. Cause I mean, you can only watch so much. And so, I mean, yeah, it's great if you have all these options, but you can only watch so much. So I scaled back some of it. And I think I got it down to $50, which is, I think, still under what cable bill was. But I think a lot of people were in my situation where if you do Sling and all the on-demand options, you can get it to like $70-$80, which is pretty much what a cable bill is.
Well, yeah, but I don't have any of that. I mean, I've got basically Netflix is all I have. Prime? And then I have Prime, but I basically amortize that through the Prime subscription because I use the shipping and everything else. So I would have that anyway, but I don't think, I mean, if I didn't have Prime, I would not subscribe to Prime because it's kind of my backup. Man, Netflix really let me down. And then I'll pop over to like yesterday I watched 3:10 to Yuma on Prime and it's so hit or miss. But that's all I have is Netflix and Prime. But then again, who has time to work when you're hustling?
You don't have Sling?
Huh? No, oh. I have, I'm slingless.
How do you watch, like news and stuff?
Tyler. I really don't. I don't watch any news once. I have an antenna so I can get the local stations. I watch. In fact, this is a perfect segue. So really the only thing I've been watching these days is Saturday evening and Sunday evening golf.
That's awesome. That's super relaxing.
That's what Emma calls my nap time. Cause as soon as golf comes on, I'm pretty much going to be out at some point in the next hour. So I wanted to ask your opinion. Is Tiger back? What have you thought about his progress this year?
He's not back. I mean, he's not the Tiger. He's not the Tiger of 99 or I guess 98, 2000 when he won like 12 majors, but he is way, way better than I think anyone thought. I mean, because when he first had that comeback a couple of years ago, and I don't even know if he made it to the second round. I think he shot like a 78 or something. He was on my back, and he was out. And so people didn't exactly have the highest expectation. I mean, the guy had his spine fused. That's just nuts. And you see, you know, just how much torque he has in his swing. People did not have high expectations, and the fact that he's contended in a couple tournaments has been, I think, amazing. I mean, golf is absolutely thrill because they just, I mean, Tiger's Tiger. I mean, it's like Michael Jordan. Didn't matter how many times he came back, it's Michael Jordan. I'll tell you, if there's any doubt that we love, talent, greatness, I don't know how you would phrase it, but I mean, they're pretty much everyone's forgotten about what Tiger, I mean, Tiger got accused of some crazy things. I mean, he had all the, you know, had the affair with like 18 women, and then he had the DUI, and I mean, just some crazy things happening in his life. And the entire crowd at every tournament is cheering him on like he's our son and he's about to win his first tournament. It's the excitement is there, and you can just feel everybody pulling for him. I mean, it's almost everything has been forgotten. And so, yeah, I'm pretty happy with his progress. I would love to see him win a tournament. I thought the Masters, I thought it was just going to be something was going to happen. He was just going to catch fire. Wasn't to be. But I think if he can win one tournament this year and do pretty well in like a major, because I think he finished top five at the Players, which is considered the unofficial fifth major.
Yeah,
he did. And so, mm-hmm. If he could just win one tournament, because what's happening is he's not able to finish. The one thing that Tiger always did. Was finish. I mean, it was like death if you had to face him in a playoff. I think he only had one loss, and it was the first playoff he ever was in on the PGA Tour. Ever since then, he won every single one. And he's not being Tiger down the line. I mean, that's the unfortunate thing. And so, also another statistic about Tiger is that Tiger has never come from behind on the fourth round. And so, every tournament he's been going into, he's been behind. And so that's just a different mindset that he has to be in. And for him, it's always been about maintaining the lead. Now he has to make some moves. And I think that's a different mindset entirely. And so I think if he can adjust all those things and the fact that his game is so much better, but Father Time, chasing after him, what is he, 42, 43? So won his last major at 46. Now Tiger's in a lot better shape than Nicholas was. But, I mean, in a blue moon, someone can contend. Steve Stricker was doing pretty well, I think, either last week or the week before. He's 51, 52. You can have a round, and you might even be able to have a shot. And Tiger, of course, is in a league all of his own. But I would say he's probably got 5 years of winning majors left. After 5 years, there's no way. I mean, the talent pool is just too deep. I mean, these young guys, they're so good. And Tiger knows that. So he's doing a lot better. So I think he's still got a shot. I think he's still got a shot at maybe winning another major or two. But he's got to kick it in.
Well, and just think about how all of these players are so good and they're there because of watching him play. Like, I mean, that's been his downfall.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. Depending on how you look at it. No, I mean, that's 100% true. All these young guys watched. It's really like bizarre because, you know, when I first started playing golf, Tiger was like the young phenom. He was 19, 20 years old. And it's so weird to see him as like the older guy, like the 40-year-old who's got back problems playing against the young bucks. And it's just like weird to see. And so, yeah, but I would say he's probably got, I would say 4 years, maybe five. And so if he can win a major this year and get in that mindset, he's just got to get back in that mindset that he can win. I think he has a lot of doubt. I mean, that's what happens when you don't win. I mean, it's, you know, you don't do something for a while. It's hard to get back into it, especially with the talent that's out there. But I think he's got a shot. I think he's got a shot. I don't know if he's going to, you know, he's at 14 majors. Nicholas had 18. I don't know if he's going to get there, but if he hopes to, he probably have to win a major this year. But he's definitely got to win at least one tournament to get him back in that mindset. But he is better than I thought. I think a lot of people thought he was going to be. I mean, I think he said two or three top fives, which is just nuts to think about.
Yeah, I mean, and I've been wanting to get your perspective on that for a couple of weeks, probably since after the Masters. And,
I actually had him. And
we just didn't have
I
a
actually thought he was going to win. I thought I actually put some play money, some fake money, on just for fun, gentleman's agreement. I thought Tiger was going to win the Masters. He was my pick. Like I was like, I feel pretty good about him. And that might have been a little bit. I was blinded by, you know, sort of the heyday of Tiger, but I also, I mean, I think the week before the Masters or 2 weeks, he hasn't played the week before. 2 weeks before, I mean, he was in the thick of it, and I thought, man, it was a good feel. And so, I mean, he had a shot. I thought the magic might strike, lightning might strike. But no, I mean, I think he's doing way better than everyone thought. But I think now people are starting to build the expectation back up, and so he's really gonna have to kick it into gear and at least win one tournament. He wins one tournament. I don't know. I think that could be enough to spark that fire inside of him, and we could see him make a run at Nicholas's record. But he's got to get back in that winning mindset. I think he's still kind of like, man, I'm just glad to be out here and be in contention. And he's got to get back to the Tiger of I'm going to win by 10 shots.
Hey, it's going to be tough. I mean, this weekend, what did they finish with, 17 or something outrageous?
Oh, the Byron Nelson. Yeah,
it was. Yeah. It was a pretty big, I don't know what you call it. It was a good score.
I mean, the same thing. The players, which I mean, historically has been an insanely difficult golf course. I think each day of that tournament, someone tied the course record. It was just nuts. And so, yeah, I mean, that's playing a factor in the. There's just so many things golf. The technology, the one thing that Tiger also did at the sport was he worked out. And all these young guys are working out and they're hitting the ball a mile. You're back in the day, I mean, golfers, I mean, that was kind of the joke, right? Golfers and bowlers were sort of the sport that the lazy guy could do. And now all of a sudden these guys are like, I mean, it's like nuts how in shape these guys are for golfers. I mean, these are guys that could have played like football or baseball or something else and decided to play golf instead. And so that's, I mean, there's just so many things that have changed about golf since Tiger started playing, and he has to contend with that. I mean, he changed the game. Unfortunately, he changed it to be more like him. And so now he's got to compete against people just like him. And so that's a whole different mindset for him. But I think, like I said, I think he had it. I think if he can win one tournament this year, that could spark it. But even if he doesn't, he's still doing a lot better than anyone thought he was going to do.
Absolutely. And I'm glad to get your perspective on that, because you're my resident golf guru. Because I basically didn't even know what it was until until college there. So, you know, I'm not from the golf elitist background like you.
Well, I am a country club Republican, as I'm told. Unfortunately, I'm not a member of any country club, so it doesn't really fit. But what's funny is, I don't want to be a member of a club that would have me as a member. Who was that? Was that Oscar Wilde? Who was that?
Someone.
I think that's probably a pretty good argument for most. But what's funny is that I basically quit golf from about 2004 to about 2014. So I basically took 10 years off of golf, and so I just got back into playing it. I'm trying to get my game back. I'll tell you this. I haven't said this anywhere publicly, but I feel confident I can say it here. Is that
it's just between us girls?
Is that okay. I have a goal to qualify for the Carolinas Amateur. Because I used to play some amateur tournaments back when I was in college. You know, obviously I played in college, and then during the summer I'd play, try to qualify for the U.S. Amateur. I never did. I think the best was I made it past the first round of the U.S. Amateur one time, of the qualifier. I made it past the first round. But so I was like, you know what? If I can get my game back and get somewhat decent, I think and the reason is that in 2020 it's going to be in Wilmington. So that'd be really cool. I could talk about it on the air and everything. And so that's like my goal. So I got 2 years this summer. So 2 years from probably about right now, the qualifier will be to qualify for this thing. So that's my goal.
Well, we need to wrap this episode up so you can go watch 10 Cup.
No,
and get
don't
ready,
watch
man.
That. Oh my gosh, that's the worst. That's like how not to become a golf pro.
Happy Gilmore?
Legend of Bagger Vance, maybe. That's not bad.
Maybe.
10 Cup system, that's just maybe. Such a depressing ending. Guy almost went to the U.S. Open, puts 4 in the drink. That's not what I want to do, even close. But I guess to be in contention wouldn't be too bad. But yeah, we got to wrap it up.
All right. We'll wrap it up, but I'll tell you what, when you play, I'll be your caddy.
I actually already got some. Well, I already got somebody. They've already said they got my back. Yeah.
Oh, well, you know what? Never mind, Tyler. Never mind. I didn't want to be your caddy.
I'm just letting you know, just because I was talking about this with some friends, and a buddy of mine was like, I got your back. I'm going to do it. If you qualify, I'm going to caddy for you. And so he already said it. So he might back out. But I can't turn
well,
off.
Well, if he does. And otherwise, I want to thank everyone for listening to the last episode of Tavern Voices. we'll try to keep the streak alive and see everyone next week.
See everyone, and I appreciate we've now made this a golf podcast. That's a good thing.
That's right. And now to the 18th.